It's at the letters for Wednesday, July 24th, 2024. Arden Swelling and Ben Nicholson Smith, our producers, are Christian Ryan and Nick Andrade. Thank you so much for listening. We are only 6 days away from MLB's trade deadline, so I suppose that this podcast will serve as somewhat of a deadline preview, and I hope that you all listen to it sometime prior to, I don't know, like 2 hours to the deadline on the 30th, because I don't know that anything too crazy is going to happen till then.
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair. Honestly, MLB executives love just waiting until the last possible moment before a deadline and then making their decision. And it's just their way of doing things. So, I've heard from folks within MLB front offices that are, you know, of course they work very hard, they're very prepared, they're making sure that everything is lined up and they know all their different contingencies, but are they actually talking trade, like actively? You know, are they actually negotiating yet? Not really. So yeah, I think Monday, Tuesday, those will be the really busy days. Hopefully it happens earlier. You know, hopefully this is the year that July 25th and 26th are busy days, but I think it'll be the 29th and 30th.
Yeah, I mean, Sunday at the earliest, but it's almost a thing where when you come this far, like you might as well go to the end, because both buyers and sellers see waiting up until the deadline is leverage for similar reasons on both sides, right? Like they both have other alternatives and know that the opposition buyer or seller ultimately has to make a move, whether you're the seller with a pending free agent that you have to trade to get some value in return, or you're the buyer with a hole on your roster that you have to fill because you're trying to qualify for the postseason and then do well once you're there. So it's kind of like this leverage kind of cancels each other out, but both sides are trying to leverage it. It just becomes a bit of a staring contest until like 24 to 48 hours before the deadline, when, you know, these two sides that don't want to blink first finally get down to it and say, okay, like, let's put aside the procrastination here and get down to it and actually deliberate on trades.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, for the Blue Jays, it's actually pretty obvious and clear, like they're going to sell. We'll get into that. It's not really nuanced. That's what they have to do. That's what they will do. But for a lot of teams that are around 53-50, you know, 51-48, 48-53, then you're 5 wins or 5 losses away from having a massively different outlook, right? So take the Texas Rangers, who, as we record this right now, are 49-52. And to me, they're probably the biggest swing team in all of this. They're not the only swing team. But let's say the Rangers go undefeated. Keep in mind, they're playing the White Sox, they're playing the Blue Jays, two very beatable teams. So if they go 5-0 before the deadline, then all of a sudden they're over 500. Like, they're the defending World Series champions. Maybe they decide to go for it. But if they go 0-5, it's clear they sell. All of a sudden, the pitching market is flooded. You have Kirby Yates, David Robertson. You have Scherzer potentially out there, Heaney, Eovaldi. The whole pitching market changes. So buyers want to wait to see if those Rangers pitchers become available. Sellers then have to wait because the buyers are waiting. And you just end up in the stalemate until the 30th or the 29th.
Yeah, and you even look at the NL, where you've got four teams that have pretty solid playoff probabilities in the Phillies and Braves in the NL East, the Brewers in the Central, and the Dodgers in the West. But beyond them, there are four more teams that all have Fangraphs playoff odds between 40-50%. The Mets, the Cardinals, the Padres, and the Diamondbacks. And assuming that the four teams with the playoff probabilities of like 85% and above make the playoffs, that leaves only two more spots for those other four teams that can very easily convince themselves that they can reach the postseason and that they can claim one of those final two wildcard spots. But the reality is, two of those teams are going to play their final game in the regular season and then go golfing. So as much as I want to kind of jump on the equivocation of MLB front offices right now, I do see their argument that, like, look, a run of play this week, a few wins, a few losses, or a critical injury occurring at a crucial spot, that can dramatically alter our strategy heading into July 30th.
Yeah, I think that they should wait as long as they do. And I think it makes a lot of sense. I think it's the right move to wait. And I think it's even pretty good still from an entertainment standpoint. I fully expect that we'll see dozens of trades on the 29th and 30th. The Blue Jays will trade two players, maybe more, probably more. So there's going to be activity. I mean, it's really just a question of where and when and, you know, who's coming back and all these different things. So there are a lot of different variables and there's a lot of intrigue. And I think it's a pretty fun time of year just because I don't want to use the word opportunity because I don't want to sound like I'm in an MLB front office.
This guy went to MIT.
Yeah, we can. I think we can do better than that and be a bit more clear. But it is a good chance. It's a time in the year where you can acquire prospects, where you can acquire minor leaguers, maybe major leaguers. You can get good players, right? That's what all teams are trying to do. They're trying to get good players. This is a time of year you can get good players. So to put it really simply, that's fun. That's an exciting time.
This guy reads Adam Grant. Look at him go. Look, I said alternatives earlier, right? So we all do it. We're all pilled in that way. But yeah, I think that, look, as it pertains to the Blue Jays, like you kind of got into it a bit earlier, we can just knock off some very low-hanging fruit quickly. Let me know if you kind of agree with this picture of the Blue Jays strategy that I'm going to paint going into the deadline. Number one, the Blue Jays will actively seek trades for their pending free agents. Number two, they will listen to offers on their free agents beyond this, you know, after 2025, but not necessarily actively shop them. And then number three, it's extremely unlikely that Vladimir Guerrero Jr. or Bo Bichette gets moved.
Straightaway center back in the Rogers Center, and now he lifts one to straightaway center again. Pham is back, and he did it again. Bo Bichette lines one out to straightaway center for his fourth home run of the season.
That's how I kind of see it right now. How do you?
I think that's fair. And just to expand on that a little bit, when it comes to their pending free agents, like my understanding from talking to folks with other teams, from talking to people with the Blue Jays, my understanding is they're like shopping them, you know, like it's, hey, look at how good Yusei Kikuchi is. This guy's nasty. He's so good. Like you guys, he would be perfect for you. Like it's a little bit of a sales pitch and that's good. That's what they should be doing. That applies to the free agents. Those guys clearly available. We'll get into later in the pod how likely it is that those guys move, where it is that they could move, but suffice to say that they are very much available. Then, or I guess to dial it back to 2024, like right now it's a lost season. Everyone knows that is a lost season. But 2025, they want to, my understanding is, they want to prop the door open to, hey, what if we want to add in the offseason? What if we want to add and compete and try to contend in 2025? Well, if you're keeping that possibility open, you want to have Vladdy around, you want to have Gausman, Bassett, because they can help you in 2025. And look, we can debate, there's a debate to be had on whether that reset should happen sooner, but I'm just describing what I believe to be the case right now. And my belief and understanding is that they want to prop that door open in case there is a way to compete in 25. So that means it's going to be hard to get a Vlad Jr. And the Blue Jays aren't going to do you any favors and frame the value or frame the ask on him. It is going to have to be you just go in blind and you make a huge offer to the Blue Jays and you see if it happens, and it probably doesn't.
Yeah, and I'm open to like hearing various perspectives and arguments. Like if you want to argue the Blue Jays should full on tear down and trade Vlad and trade Bo and just like burn it down to the studs, like I'll hear that argument. If you want to say that they should only trade the pending guys, I'll hear that argument. If you want to say they should really seriously consider trading like your Bassetts and Gausmans and Barrioses of this world, okay, I'll hear that argument as well. Like I'm open-minded to all of it, but like you, my sense very strongly is that you are not going to see a full-on teardown and you are not going to see a multi-year rebuild. There is no interest from this front office or ownership in doing that. The roster is going to naturally look different on opening day 2025. That just happens every year. There will be trades. There will be new players who arrive via free agency. And the core of this roster will naturally look different in 2026 and 2027 as guys like Vlad and Bo and Chris Bassett and Kevin Gausman all kind of come to the end of their deals with the Blue Jays. And many of those players are likely to leave via free agency. So there will be like a natural turnover here that will happen progressively. But I do believe that the team that takes the field on opening day 2025 will have a very similar core to the one that you see now and will likely be built to compete for a playoff spot.
Yeah, I think the safe default right now is that they're going to try to compete in 2025. I don't think that's locked in stone for a variety of reasons. which basically boiled down to, you know what? We don't have the full information on the 2024 season yet. We don't know what the Blue Jays were able to get back in trades at the deadline. We don't know what health is going to look like, whether it's for major leaguers, whether it's for minor leaguers like Ricky Tiedemann. And we don't know what performance is going to look like down the stretch, again, for minor leaguers and also for major leaguers like Spencer Horwitz or Davis Schneider, who are still establishing what it is that they are at the major league level. For someone like Jose Berríos, whose performance and whose stuff have dropped off this year, but clearly a pitcher who's proven capable of rebounding in the past. All those things will inform the Blue Jays after this season as far as what 2025 looks like. And I don't think it's off the table that they decide to reset, depending on how all those things unfold. Nor do I think it's off the table that, hey, they try to go into it, they try to compete. You go into 2025, hey, this time next year, they're 53-47. Boom, you push hard at the deadline, try to make big additions and see what happens down the stretch in 2025, which would probably be your final year with Vladdy.
And this one sent to deep center field. It is gone. And he just keeps on swinging it. Another home run for Vladimir Guerrero Jr., and it's got the Blue Jays on the board.
Yeah, I think that the 2025 deadline could actually be the very pivotal point for this team where, like, really hard, like, sweeping decisions are made, like, as you outlined there, where it's either, yep, we're going to push in hard with this, like, one last go with Vlad and, you know, whoever else is still around from that core, and we're going to go for it right here. And if it doesn't work, then we're probably going to have to, you know, tear this thing apart come the off season. But if you have another season like 24 in 25, well, then you better bet that a lot of players who have sold a lot of jerseys for this team are going to be heading out of town. That's just the situation. But like, I do think retooling, refreshing, whatever you want to call it, and trying to contend for the postseason in 2025 is very realistic. Like, I think that that's something that the Blue Jays could execute. I don't think that building a juggernaut that's going to like run away with the AL East is realistic. I think that's rather unlikely. But I do think that with this team's core and with some of the complementary players that we've seen introduced this year who have shown that while maybe not like everyday regulars at the top of your lineup, you know, a Spencer Horwitz, a Davis Schneider, and Ernie Clement can be like ancillary pieces of a decent team. I think that in a 12-team postseason landscape with like $200 million to spend on payroll, there's really no reason you shouldn't be able to build a team capable of winning 88 games and getting into a wild card series. Like, there are numerous recent examples of teams that had underwhelming seasons with pretty good rosters, whether you want to look at like the Mets or the Padres last year, the Cardinals even. They're all back in the wild card mix this year after disappointing years in 2023. Like, there are very easy examples to point to in the last 2 years where these are teams that, like, with rosters built to win, underwhelmed the year prior, reset, made some moves, sold off at the deadline, and then came back the year following and now are in the postseason mix. So I think that, like, I've said this before, people just get way too down on teams that underperform and way too high on teams that overperform. But I think that the Blue Jays, they aren't in this disastrous scenario where they're obviously going to lose 100 games next year if they don't have massive sweeping changes. I do think that, you know, if they keep the same core, make some creative trades, sign a few veteran free agents on short-term deals this winter, spend their money shrewdly, I think they can definitely build a team that can compete for a wild card spot in 2025.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. And I think, like, hey, maybe it's even some veterans on short-term deals. And this is, okay, now I'm inserting my own opinion here. Okay, this is not reporting. But, like, you can also sign some younger players on long-term deals and just add to your core and keep spending, you know?
Like, it's an option.
That's, yeah. Now, what I think is more likely, what I've been told is more likely, is what you're describing, which is the veterans on short-term deals. So, you know, now we're back into the reporting of things. But I think that, yeah, it's so true that when you look at the last few years and like it's been awful, like the endings have been awful for the Blue Jays every single year, right? 21, they miss on the final game. 22, it's the crash in center field and the Blue Jays are swept by the Mariners and they blow this lead. 23, it's the Berríos decision. They're swept again. 24, just abysmal season start to finish. So yeah, I could totally understand why Blue Jays fans have kind of become conditioned to think that only bad things are going to happen. And I'm not here to say you should have blind faith, okay? Like, that's not what I'm trying to say. But let's not forget that good things can also happen. And I know people are down on Ross Atkins, and I understand the frustration is totally, totally valid when you look at a season like this. But it's not like Ross Atkins is incapable of making good moves either. So, you know, we saw it in 21 when he signed Semien and Ray, and all of a sudden you have an MVP finalist and a Cy Young winner on your team because of a really good offseason. So it is not that that is impossible to do. Now, we don't know that Ross Atkins is definitively, you know, going to be running things this offseason. We also don't know that he's definitively going to be fired. So anyone who speaks with a lot of certainty on that, I think, might want to sort of question that assumption that they're making one way or the other. All of this to say that it is possible to win next year.
To your point, like, I know that there's like a lot of speculation about Ross Atkins' job security, and it's understandable because any GM who's been in their position for a long time, you know, Ross has been the GM of the Blue Jays for 9 years and has a very like underwhelming, disappointing season, obviously is going to have a microscope put on them. And that's just like the nature of media markets, particularly a very large one like Toronto. But I feel like you and I haven't really engaged on that very much, certainly not on this podcast, probably only when we're like asked to directly by somebody else. And just speaking for myself, that's because I don't have like a clear sense of where the Blue Jays are leaning on Ross Atkins going into next year. Like, it's a very hard thing to report or to gain insight on, because you can't just go to like team decision makers and go, hey, you're gonna fire your GM. You know, like, you can't just not in the same way
we could. If there was a formal avail with Mark Shapiro, then that is a question that would be asked. And that sure, there hasn't been that sort of venue for that.
I guess what I'm referring to is more so the way that you and I gain the information that informs right, our opinions, which, as you just, you know, said, like, you know, reporting versus opinion, right? Like, often we will say things that is based on information that we've gotten on background that, you know, informs the things that we say about this team and the things they're likely to do. But it's very hard to report around something like a GM's job status. It's something you kind of have to like reverse engineer through like a constellation of conversations based on, you know, picking out little pieces of each one and trying to like pin together on the bulletin board this map of where things stand. So like, I don't like to just talk out of my ass. So I'm not going to come on here and say Ross is going to be fired or Ross is going to be back, because I truly don't know. And I don't think that anybody knows. So I think you make a great point that people are just presuming in one way or another. I don't know how they arrive at those conclusions so definitively, particularly people who aren't around the team every day. I will say that, like, from the various conversations that I've had recently, Ross was very much in charge of the draft. Ross is very much in charge of the deadline. Like, he is, like, nothing has changed about his involvements in these like very high leverage decisions that the club is making at this time of year. And I also haven't gotten the impression that like he's gonna be let go at the end of the season. If anything, if I was betting, and this is my opinion now, this is just me saying, if I had to wager, I would bet that Ross Atkins is going to be the Blue Jays GM in 2025.
Yeah. And I bet a lot of people are sitting there surprised right now hearing that. And yet he's under contract for 2025. Actually, he's under contract for 2026 as well.
Yeah.
So it's not on the surface of it. It's actually, you know, it's far from a controversial statement, right? Except for the way things have unfolded as far as, you know, the expectation is, I think a lot of people have made a certain assumption that it's already been decided, that the die has already been cast, that Ross Atkins has essentially already been fired. I think that anyone who's talking about this with like a huge amount of conviction and authority probably just wants to check that and just have the humility to say, okay, is this actually going to happen? Do I really know that he's going to be fired? Or is it more of an open question? And I think at minimum, it's an open question. And I think that certainly I've talked to other people in the game, many other people in the game who aren't connected to the Blue Jays, who are wondering the same thing and who are wondering, is Ross Atkins going to be the GM? And Mark Shapiro has not, you know, spoken and given him an endorsement and a vote of confidence publicly. And that would answer those questions for better or for worse. Look, I honestly don't know. And I do believe that internally at the very, very high levels of the Blue Jays organization, Ross Atkins in the front office are being evaluated. I think that that is something that any responsible front office would do. And I'm sure the Blue Jays would be doing that to evaluate Ross Atkins. Would I rule out the possibility that Ross Atkins is reassigned? No. Are other teams speculating about that? Absolutely. But I'm not going to sit here and say I have something to report, because I don't. We know Ross Atkins is the GM now. I don't have anything to report on his status beyond that, you know? So I can speculate. We all might have, you know, different opinions about what moves he's made that are good and bad and in the balance. Is he a good GM? Is he not a good GM? Look, that's a massive discussion, and one that, of course, we'll continue to have here on ATL. But I think that as of this moment, like, yeah, he is the GM. And so it probably makes sense just to remember that when we're discussing this, because sometimes I'll do radio hits and it's like he's already been fired. And I'm like, whoa.
No, yeah. And sometimes you'll hear people position it as in, like, he's just been pushed off to the corner of the front office. And, you know, James Click is running things, or, you know, somebody, you know, Mark Shapiro is actually making all the big decisions. And, like, Ross is just, like, getting everybody coffee. Ross is still very much in charge of the draft. Yeah. Which actually is, like, way more important than the deadline, honestly, when you want to talk about the future and viability of this franchise, and also of the deadline. So go ahead.
Yeah, and just one last thing there. Like, again, so this is reporting. This is sharing to the extent that I have anything to report. It's sharing, you know, those thoughts. I know people listening to this might be surprised, might be disappointed. I'm not saying anything new here. I'm not trying to, like, break news or anything. I'm just saying that, like, this is an uncertain thing right now. Let's remember that. And it's, to be in an uncertain position as a GM, it's probably not where Ross Atkins thought he was going to be 12 months ago when he was leading a contending team that seemed to have this core that you'd build around. So to that end, being in an uncertain position reflects, you know, how badly things have gone for this franchise in the course of the last 12 months and how disappointing this team has been. And I don't think that it's off the table that he gets reassigned after, you know, at some point toward the end of this season. I would think that that's under consideration, but he's the GM right now.
Yeah. To your point, like, there will be an evaluation process. Like, Ross has bosses who evaluate him, just like all of us have bosses that evaluate us. Like, that's just how the world works. But I, like, also to your point, like, I think that the model of that evaluation will go far, far, far beyond wins and losses in a baseball season. It's going to come down to, like, the value that you were able to gain in trade. It's, you know, how well did your minor league free agents work out? How well did your, you know, what was the return on your contracts? There's a lot of things that are outside of Ross Atkins' control, like whether it's, like, Alec Manoah or Jordan Romano having surgeries, or it's, like, Bo Bichette just having this absolutely disastrous season. Like, there's a lot of things that have gone wrong for the Blue Jays that aren't going to be directly held against Ross Atkins when that evaluation happens. I mean, he will be evaluated on how he has positioned this franchise going forward and the types of, like, just how much value he has gained this year versus last and the success of his moves. But, like, I could tell you with certainty, like, that evaluation is not just going to be, oh, the Blue Jays lost 88 games this year, so, and he's been there for a while, so he has to be fired. Like,
nor is it going to be fans want him fired, so he's going to be fired.
If anything, if we can say something with certainty, it is that Mark Shapiro is unafraid to make publicly unpopular moves. Like, we've seen this throughout his career. So if it's publicly unpopular that Ross Atkins is back in 2025, Mark Shapiro doesn't care. Like, he is unafraid of doing something that is going to catch a lot of blowback from fans and from the industry. Something that he has also shown throughout his career is that he very much values continuity and stability in management. And he is someone who believes that season to season, you can have these fluxes of, like, a 90 win season one year because a lot of things went your way, and a 72 win season the next year because a lot of things went wrong for you. But I think that he believes that over a 3 to 5 year period, if you are, and I'm not trying to put him in, like, the 54% camp, but if you are generally building winners and winning over time, like, that's, he's going to evaluate it in that window, in that gap, 3, 4, 5, 6 years. Like, that's the way they look at this in spans. It's not just going to be myopic on 2024 and how things went in this very thin 6-month window.
Yeah, accurate. There will be a zoom out. I do think that when you look at the industry, GMs pay for their jobs when the team underperforms and when the long-term positioning is not there. And looking at the Blue Jays, the team is underperforming and the long-term positioning is not there. So those ingredients are not in Ross Atkins's favor. And, you know, look, if his job was super secure,
wouldn't be having this conversation.
Yeah, exactly. We wouldn't be having this conversation. But yeah, there's a lot that goes into it. Being a GM at the major league level is super complex, requires a lot of different skills. Ross Atkins has some of those skills, and some of those skills, like communicating with the fans, have not been there at times. So it's an ongoing discussion, as I understand it. We will see where this goes. But he's the GM right now, and I just hesitate to say anything much more definitive than that.
Yeah, totally agree. We should probably step away because we're going to get a bit more granular than that when we return on At the Letters.
Listen to At the Letters ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
It continues on At the Letters. Arden Zwelling and Ben Nicholson Smith. Our producers are Christian Ryan and Nick Andrad. Ben, you have a very insightful piece up at sportsnet.ca today in which you examine trade scenarios for the Blue Jays' various top candidates. So I want to just take you through each of the individuals in question here, get your take on it. I'll give a quick take and we'll kind of rapidly move through these. Sound good to you?
Yeah, that sounds great. I know people have heard a lot of speculation on these guys already. I'm going to try to just be concise, give the short version of what's going on, and then maybe with some, if there's more discussion, then we can break down some different ideas there.
Yeah, I've got like two guys that I have maybe a bit more to say about, but otherwise, yeah, we can move through these pretty quickly. So let's start with Yusei Kikuchi, who has to be just the highest possible value piece that the Blue Jays have to move this deadline, correct?
Yusei Kikuchi getting a nice warm ovation. And again, who knows, Joe, but it stands to reason he is not going to be a Blue Jay beyond the deadline.
0-2. Swing and a miss, strike three. Kikuchi pulls the string with the changeup there, gets Malloy on three pitches. There are two down.
Agreed. I think that he is their best trade chip. He is one of the best starting pitchers out there, depending on what you think about Jack Flaherty and the state of his back and the injections that he continues receiving in it. Garrett Crochet, obviously, not a rental. Tarek Skubal, not a rental. Kikuchi, he's going to be very, very desirable. I think you look at left-handed, great stuff, better command. Only making $10 million. He fits on small market teams like the Brewers and Twins. He fits on bigger market teams like the Astros. And the Orioles certainly would be a fit. The Guardians would be a fit. Don't think the Dodgers are a fit. Just with Shohei, they already have a ton of Japanese attention and media. And I don't know if that's, going to be the move that they make. Although Yusei and Shohei are certainly on good terms and know each other for a very long time. He will be traded. It's a question of where. It's a question of when. But he will be traded, and the Blue Jays should get something pretty good back.
Yeah, and I think that the results from his recent outings will not have a huge say in just what the Blue Jays can get back or just how desirable he is from other clubs. Like, yes, obviously you want someone who's pitching well, but like I do think that clubs have gotten so far beyond like their value on the results has minimized a lot in terms of what they look at the deadline. They look a lot more at process. So they look at what's your velo in these starts? What's the movement on your pitches? How do you look on the mound? Are you confident? Are you second guessing? Do you appear to be out of your delivery and fighting to find an adjustment? Or are you confident in your delivery and repeating it? And is your release point consistent? And are our pro scouts who are there seeing you interacting well with your teammates and going into the dugout and looking fine? You know, like I think that stuff matters a lot more than Yusei Kikuchi having a career high 13 strikeouts against the Giants or like getting hit around by the Diamondbacks. Like the results are the results. I just think that as long as the process is sound, which it has been with Kikuchi, his value should be consistent.
Yeah, he's a playoff starter on a good team. He could start game three of the division series. He could start game two of an ALCS for somebody. He's someone whose stuff plays. Now, I don't think you want to push him three times through in a playoff game. I think you run him twice through and you try to get him through 18 batters and you see what that looks like. Is that four innings, five innings in a really high stakes playoff game? You're not trying to get him into the seventh inning, but this is a really, really good pitcher, and he can get outs in October. I think knowing Yusei Kikuchi, the person, a little bit, he's someone who adjusting to a new environment might take a little bit of time. It might take a couple starts. So that's probably worth remembering too. But some of these teams have big buffers. They don't need to max out their wins in August and September, and they can afford to acclimate a newcomer into their organization and get him as comfortable as possible. And so I think that that would be a good thing to keep in mind with Kikuchi.
Yeah, I think the two trips through thing is real with Kikuchi. We've seen him hit a bit of a wall right around the 18th, 19th batter in his last couple of outings, or around that kind of fifth or sixth inning. But like, here's the thing. If he's your number three playoff starter on a good team, you're only asking him to take two trips through. And because you're a good team and a contender, you have a pretty good bullpen and you have pretty good weapons to bring in behind him. So all you need is that two trips through or those five innings. I mean, in general, we're seeing a world in which the postseason games are just managed so differently than regular season games. You're not really asking anybody to give you seven innings. Like, I mean, are the Braves asking Chris Sale to give them seven innings in the playoffs? Will the Phillies be pushing Christopher Sanchez into the seventh? I don't know. I think that it's much more likely that you've built out your bullpen. You're going to be much more aggressive. And when you pull a starter, you're going to have some real pockets and matchups in mind in those middle innings for certain relievers. So I think if anything, if Kikuchi's biggest flaw that he's shown recently is that he has a tough time the third trip through, I don't think that a lot of playoff teams would look at that as that big of a detriment.
Exactly. And his struggles against Arizona and then against Detroit, it came late in the game. And look, that's not a positive, but he can get you five really good innings, and that matters a lot.
Okay, Jimmy Garcia, he returns from the injured list where he was out with a little bit of an elbow nerve issue, comes back, strikes out the side against the Tigers. Velo's there, stuff's there, depth of repertoire is there. He's throwing the strikes. I mean, it's just as good of a return from a month on IL as the Blue Jays could have been hoping for. Seems like his value is not in question going into the deadline either.
Exactly. I think he needs at least one more outing, probably two more outings. If I'm the Blue Jays, no way do I pitch him on a back-to-back. I tell everyone that he's available for three in a row, and then I use him with 2 days rest in between these outings. No chance you want to push that and endanger his value after he came back. And I mean, he looked unbelievable against the Tigers. His stuff is just nasty. He commands it. Like you said, he has the multiple breaking pitches. This is a guy who could get the last out of the World Series. His trade value is very high, and the Blue Jays will trade him.
Yeah, and you want to be pretty purposeful about when you use him as well. The wins and losses right now are really pretty irrelevant for the Blue Jays. So I don't know that you're going to be extending Jimmy Garcia too many pitches in an outing. I don't know if you're going to throw him into the toughest part of the lineup in the toughest situation. If you can find those kind of, still leverage spots, but not exactly facing down Judge, Soto, whoever, if you can, and the Blue Jays aren't playing the Yankees, so it won't be an issue, but the Blue Jays can be kind of purposeful with how they use him down the stretch here, just in order to maintain that value and not have that come into question.
Yeah, I wouldn't use him for a single up down. I wouldn't stretch him for more than, 22 pitches. Once he throws his 20th pitch, it's last batter to me. I'm not messing around. There's no way he's throwing a 35-pitch outing for me at this point.
Okay, Kevin Kiermaier is someone who has already passed through waivers. So we know that 29 other teams could have had Kevin Kiermaier merely for covering the final $4.5 million, whatever it is, on his contract this year. They all said no. That gives you a pretty good idea of how low his value is. That said, as an exceptional defender, as a solid base runner, as a veteran who's been around, strong clubhouse presence, good energy guy, someone who's played in the postseason before, it seems likely that someone somewhere would be willing to move a lottery ticket to get Kevin Kiermaier on their bench for the postseason.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, you look at, and I think there might be a perception out there that because he was on waivers and everyone passed on him, that means that, he won't be traded. And, He won't be traded with a team taking on the full freight. I think that's pretty clear. But if the Blue Jays kick in money, which they certainly can do, that money's already a sunk cost to them, then they might be able to get a somewhat intriguing prospect back, clear a little bit of money off the books, and put a veteran player in a position to, win and compete down the stretch, which would be a cool opportunity for Kiermaier at this point in his career. And I really think he can help someone. So I think it's not going to be for a top prospect. Obviously, we all understand that. But yeah, to get a lottery ticket flyer, I think that could honestly be a win-win move where someone gets an elite defender and the Jays get a lottery ticket.
I hope Kevin Kiermaier ends up on a contender, honestly. Yeah. Like, I hope he ends up in the postseason. As a Blue Jays fan, like, you should want that. This is a guy who's been just completely professional throughout his first or his only, I guess, year and a half in Toronto. And like, even talking to him after he was on waivers in a very public way, like talking to him on the day that that came out, like very fresh information. He was like a total pro. He said, like, I totally get it. I understand how I've played. I'm not emotional about it. I'm not angry about it. I'm not offended. I'm not mad at the organization. I'm very realistic about the situation this team's in and the way I've played. I need to be accountable for that. These are the things that happen. And he just said, look, whatever happens, whoever I'm playing for after this process, like, I promise you, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to try to play better than I have because it hasn't been good enough to this point. So I just thought that, like, it said a lot about him, the way he responded to being on waivers the way that he was.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Even I guess it was the next day, he was talking to Hazel and myself in Phoenix in Arizona, and again, just like such a pro. He had just cleared waivers. Essentially all the 29 other teams had just said, we don't value you at your current salary. And yeah, such a pro, I think. And then objectively, you look at the defense, you look at the base running, he's still really good.
Line to center, Kiermaier coming on, and did he catch it or trap it? The call is an out. Both the second and first base umpires are signaling that was a catch. And if it was, what a play by Kiermaier.
Especially if, you know, for teams that haven't had great center field defense, you're looking at maybe the Padres, the Guardians, the Twins, the Dodgers. Their center field defense hasn't been very good. I look at those teams as possible fits for Kiermaier.
Yeah, Justin Turner, like, similarly, someone who for a contender could fit in a different role that he's in with the Blue Jays. It's just like a bench bat, again, total pro, someone who's been to the postseason before, has performed really well there. Like, if there was ever a player who you could label as clutch, it is Justin Turner. Like, this is somebody who's raised his game in the biggest moments reliably over the course of his career. Unfortunately, the Blue Jays haven't had too many of those big moments for him to perform in this year, but somebody who you know exactly what you're getting and that I think a contender would be happy to have on their bench in the postseason. Someone who brings just like a lot of intangibles to the table and that the Blue Jays should be able to find a home for if, again, they eat some of the money, I suspect.
Yeah, exactly. He's making 13 this year. I don't think anyone would value him at that price. So I would think the Blue Jays would have to kick in money, which is fine. They're paying that salary anyway. So they get some relief, conceivably. And then I look at teams like the Cardinals and the Royals. They've struggled against lefties. Neither one of those teams has like a full-fledged DH that has to play every single day. And nor is Turner that guy at this point. He could be more off a bench. Maybe it's more selective, even pinch hitting or just depth to have extra bats around to lengthen a lineup a little bit. So I don't know that he'll necessarily be traded, but he's very available. It's like Kiermaier, all the pending free agents, very available.
Yeah, if you can bring Justin Turner off your bench against a lefty, the league leader in pitches per plate appearance, like the, you know, one of the just subjectively most professional plate appearances, most competitive plate appearances you're going to see in this league, I think there are teams that would value that. So Danny Jansen, interesting that you say in your piece here that the likelihood of a trade is lower than you'd think. So why do you believe that?
Yeah, and I guess I'm presuming that people think that a trade is sort of likely here. And again, the Jays are open to it. He's a pending free agent. Given where the Blue Jays are, they are actively listening to shopping their pending free agents, including Jansen. But you look at the numbers, he just hasn't hit well. OPS of 429 since June 1st. So that's not great. And then you just look at how hard it is to pinpoint catching to contending teams. Like, it's, you think about relievers, right? Every team needs eight relievers. Every team needs five starters. So adding relievers, it's like easy. You have eight slots for them. It's so easy to improve over one of those eight slots. But if you're talking about a starting catcher, you have two catchers on your team, one starting catcher. Not everyone needs a catcher. A lot of contenders have good catchers already. That's part of the reason they're contending. And so I think when you look at all the ingredients for Jansen, throw in the fact that Carson Kelly's also going to be traded. I don't know that there's necessarily that much of a market for him.
Yeah, if you can't sell him as like a DH who can sometimes catch, I think that does make it more difficult. Personally, I've just had like a hard time just encapsulating Jansen's market in general. Like, I don't know, really. And that extends to his free agency as well. Like, when I look ahead to the, and we've talked about this, right? The free agent catcher market upcoming is pretty light. But as you said, like, Jansen's recent offensive performance has been pretty rough. So, like, how does he fit into that market? Could he be more of like a Mitch Garver 224 guy, or is he closer to like a James McCann 440 guy? Is he somewhere in the middle there? I don't know. Like, it's very hard for me to put a value on him. It's very difficult to pin him down in both what could happen in trade here and what would happen in free agency. So I'm kind of in wait and see mode with Jansen. I wouldn't be surprised if he was moved, but I also wouldn't be surprised if he was a Blue Jay on August 1st.
Yeah, I think that of all the pending free agents, I sort of think he's the most likely to remain with the Blue Jays.
Jansen drives one to deep left, and it is gone. Number 6 on the season for Danny Jansen. That one is highlight worthy, and it is 3-0.
I just realized that I, in a very Trevor Richards thing to do, I skipped over Trevor Richards.
I thought that was deliberate, and I was going to let it go. But yes, you did skip over Trevor Richards, and he is also among their free agents.
Overlooked again, Trevor Richards. Go ahead.
It's been rough for Trevor Richards, right? Anyone watching the Jays, they know his last handful of outings. It's like home runs all over the place. It's tons of earned runs. His ERA has gone up nearly 2 runs in the course of his last 5 2/3 innings. So it's been bad. At the same time, like I said, contenders need 8 relievers each, right? There's some contenders out there that if you have a big park and you've had a bad bullpen, I would say go for it. Get Trevor Richards. And I'm looking at the Padres. I'm looking at the Mets. I see those teams as clubs that should try to get Trevor Richards. And if they try, they'll get him because it's not going to be that hard to get him.
Yeah, I get back to like the process v results thing with him. Like, obviously, yeah, he's given up some homers lately. Like, it's been rough lately. But, you know, you can't just look at the ERA. And like, ERA is a crap way to evaluate relievers in general. But I think especially with Trevor Richards, though. Like, I think it misses a lot of context with Trevor Richards because the Blue Jays have thrust him into so many various roles. Like, this guy has started games. He has mopped up middle innings. He's pitched 8th inning leverage. He's had save opportunities. Like, that's all just this year. And they've arguably overexposed him. Like, they've arguably used him too much. But that's due to the fact that the Blue Jays have had a really poor bullpen, and Richards has been one of the more reliable arms within it. So the Jays haven't had a choice but to go to him this often in so many different scenarios. Like, in a good bullpen, in a well-constructed postseason bullpen, Richards is like the 6th inning guy who is deployed really situationally. You're really like with him, like, what, regardless of the score, like, you're targeting pockets of hitters that like his changeup plays to, right? And that who haven't seen him as often as a lot of these, you know, AL lineups have seen him and aren't as familiar with him, aren't seeing him for like the second time in an outing. This is a guy who's had like 50 pitch outings this year. He'll be working less often overall with a contender, so he'll be fresher, his stuff will be crisper, he'll be recovering better between outings. He won't be this like rubber arm dude that you just go to whenever. Like, you can, if you use him a lot more strategically, I think he could be a really good fit for like the 6th or 7th spot in a contender's bullpen. So that's why I believe he'll have value at this deadline, despite what his ERA says.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the versatility, the fact that he can get lefties or righties, he's a good major league reliever to have at the back of your bullpen.
Okay, for the sake of brevity, let me lump these next 4 together and you can talk about all of them or none of them. It's the guys who are under contractual control next year. So Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, Chad Green, Chris Bassitt, and we'll throw in Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Kevin Gausman as well. So 5 guys. Like, where do you think the Blue Jays stand on some of these guys who aren't pending free agents, who they aren't actively shopping, but who they will obviously listen to proposals for?
Yes. So I will break it into 3 subcategories and briefly kind of describe each. I think with IKF and Green, the Jays are happy to keep them. The default is they keep them. They're not actively shopping them, but could they be had? Yes. And if IKF comes back, maybe within the next week, even, you know, I'm not going to call it a showcase, but he's back, then, you know, teams could look at that, and a team like Atlanta that just lost Ozzie Albies. I mean, there are a lot of clubs that could use these guys. So I certainly wouldn't be surprised if IKF or Green moves, even if the Jays are not actively shopping them. Bassett, Gausman, Vlad, these guys would be contributors on a 25 team that contends. So if the Blue Jays go down the path of trying to contend in 25, these guys would help them in that respect. Bassett and Gausman, yeah, I mean, they would be in demand if the Blue Jays were shopping them, but the Blue Jays are not shopping them. If a team approaches the Blue Jays, then the Blue Jays, of course, will look at that offer, will listen to the GM. They're not going to block, you know, Brian Cashman's number or something. So that's a possibility. With Vlad Jr., I would say it's even a little bit less likely. This is my own personal opinion now entering this, but I find it really hard for to imagine the scenario where the Blue Jays say, after all this, after all the disappointment, yep, we're just going to go and straight up trade Vlad Jr. I don't see it happening.
Yeah, I would be shocked if Vladimir Guerrero Jr. was traded at the deadline.
I would too. I honestly would be.
Yeah, I'd be floored.
And this is despite actively contemplating it almost every day. I would still be shocked.
Kind of working backwards there then. So you take like the two pitchers who are controllable, Chris Bassett and Kevin Gausman. And like, so while I think it would be really, really hard to, you know, pry Vladimir Guerrero Jr. away from the Blue Jays, I think it would be like medium hard to pry Bassett and Gausman away, medium difficult, because like they are less replaceable than say a Chad Green or an Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, who would be sort of, you know, moderate difficult to play away. You know, do you see kind of like the tiers I'm building here? Because this is where it gets down to the Blue Jays' internal evaluation of like what they have in place for 2025. Do they have someone who's like prepared to step in and throw 180 innings at like a 4.2 ERA next year? I don't really see that internally. Let me know if I'm missing someone. See it. So Chris Bass and Kevin Gausman, very hard to replace next year. And remember, the Blue Jays are trying to like keep themselves in a position where they can build a contender for 2025. Now, Chad Green, Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, you know, reliever, utility infielder, those could be more backfillable than the other two. Chad Green, obviously, with like, if internally, like a Mason Fluharty or a Connor Cook or a TJ Brock or like a Hagen Danner is ready to take the step, if the Blue Jays feel really good about those guys in their systems, or even if like an Eric Swanson, who just came back into the fold, has looked good so far, like tweaked his delivery in Buffalo, got a lot more directional and linear to the plate, sorted out some pitch tipping stuff he was dealing with. If he's ready to go back to being Eric Swanson, you can probably feel better about dealing a Chad Green and, you know, not having it leave such a crater in your bullpen. Likewise with Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, like great guy. You want to have him around. Good culture piece. Obviously a good player. He's given the Blue Jays more than they could have hoped for this year. But if you feel that like Leo Jimenez can give you something comparable from within, well, then maybe that like makes it a bit easier to say goodbye to an Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, get something similar from Jimenez next year, and then whatever the return is on that trade. So those are kind of the tiers that I would separate them into.
Yeah, agree with that. And I'll just add a little personal opinion here that I think if someone came to them with a pretty good offer for Bassett, I would do it.
Why?
Because he's getting older. You got 1 year on that deal. He's a really good pitcher, but sometimes it's better to sell a year too early than a year too late. If you can get something really meaningful back, then you go out and you use that $20, $21 million in free agency. You spend it. I'm not just sitting here saying you should just do it to save the money, but you spend that money in free agency. But if you can get something good for a trade now, maybe you get the best of both worlds.
I'd need to take a closer look at who's available in the starting pitching market, and I would need a lot more information about like who's willing to come to Toronto or not, and what kind of like, you know, the competition alternatives are going to be there. But what I do know is that like I think Chris Bassett is a pitcher who's going to age well, and who has honestly already aged well. And I think that like there's good reason to believe he can continue doing what he's done this far. Next year, maybe he takes a little step back, but like, look, Zips has him for 2025 as 147 innings pitched and a 4.10 ERA. And I just don't see anyone internally. Like, I don't think you can pencil in Bowden Francis for that. I don't think you can pencil in Chad Dallas or Ricky Tiedemann or Andrew Bash for that. You know, I just, I don't see that as easily backfillable internally. So you'd better feel pretty good as the Blue Jays, if you're going to trade Chris Bassett, about your ability to then replace that either via free agency or trade this winter.
Yeah, no, that's fair. You want to be considering all of those variables.
I do want to just take a moment here and, like, at the end of this very long podcast about who's going to stay, who's going to go, like, talking about players and sometimes front office personnel as if they're just like puzzle pieces or chess pieces, as if they like aren't human beings with lives and families and feelings and emotions, and as if these aren't like flesh and blood. Like, these aren't video game characters. Like, these are real life human beings who have a lot hung up on the deadline. And like, when a player gets traded at the deadline, like, it's not just the player who's impacted. It's their family, it's their partner, it's their kids, it's their parents, it's finding somewhere to live, it's dealing with tax implications. It's like, not like, what other industry is there where like you can just be shipped to the other side of the country to work? Like,
it's
what
other,
in what other job are you just this commodity that could be like transferred to a different organization? Like, what, at what law firm can they just say, yeah, this, just call you into the office, you know, you work in Toronto, and they can be like, yeah, sorry, you've just been traded to you know, Banks, Jeeves, and whoever in San Diego. You got to be there in 24 hours and work for them.
Arden, you've been traded to ESPN. Good luck.
Right. You got to be in Bristol tomorrow and do your job like just as well as you have been in completely unfamiliar circumstances with people you don't even know. Like, this is, it's like there is a very real human element to the trade deadline. Justin Turner and Danny Jansen have newborns, you know, Jimmy Garcia and Yusei Kikuchi have young families. Like, it, like, believe me when I say this, it sucks to be a veteran pending free agent on a losing team at the trade deadline. Because every day you've got people texting you about rumors. Arden and Ben said this about you on the podcast. What's that about? Maybe you're listening to the podcast yourself. People are asking you what's going to happen. I mean, that's another story.
Wouldn't be the first time, but yes. Yeah.
At the very least, people like you and me are like going up to players and being like, hey, how do you feel about what might happen? What do you think? Like, dude, I just did it the other day with Justin Turner, and it was just like, sorry, man, but like, I got to ask, like, you know, where are you at on this right now? And like, a point that Justin made to me was that like a big misconception that he feels a lot of kind of outsiders have, like, I don't want to say just fans, but like observers, media, anyone who's not in the player's shoes, is that people think that the player like has any idea what's going on. Like, that the player is more informed. And Justin's point was like, I've never seen a GM come down to the clubhouse and just announce the player's direction or the team's direction, or come up to a player and say, hey, here's one of the three markets you might be going to. And that's because of the uncertainty of this time of year. As we said earlier, there's a lot of teams that don't know what they're going to do. Like, the Blue Jays don't know if they're going to be able to trade all their pending free agents. They're trying to, but they ultimately, like, Danny Jansen, Justin Turner might still be Blue Jays on August 1st, and their partners might still have their newborns in Toronto condos on August 1st, or they might be in a Kansas City condo, right? Like, you just don't know. So, like, Justin's point was like, I am just like anyone else, just like trying to tune out the noise and, you know, tune out the speculation, trying to do my job to the best of my abilities amidst all this uncertainty. I am just like waiting to see what's going to happen, just like everyone else. So I think it is important to remember like the human element at the deadline and just how much is uplifted and uprooted when players are moved at this time of year.
100%. I think that's a really good point. The deadline's going to be interesting. Hopefully those players are able to, you know, get through it with minimal, you know, unnecessary stress, and hopefully fans can enjoy it. It should be a fun time of year, even if it's not the way that everyone would have hoped that this deadline would be unfolding for the Blue Jays.
It's fun for everyone but Yusei Kikuchi. And who doesn't like to see Yusei Kikuchi have fun? So hopefully he's having some fun for the Orioles in a couple weeks' time. That's going to be it for us. I want to thank our producers, Christian Ryan and Nick Andrade. I want to thank all of you for listening. He's Ben Nicholson-Smith. I'm Arden Zwelling. This has been At the Letters.